have the right to emit unlimited CO2? Or does someone living in a Pacific Island nation have the right to stop me from doing something that might submerge their entire country? This is one conflict that governments have to tackle. But let's back up for a moment. Government does not just fix the rough edges of capitalism. It makes markets possible in the first place. You'll get a lot of approving nods at a cocktail party by asserting that if government would simply get out of the way, then markets would deliver prosperity around the globe. Indeed, entire political campaigns are built around this issue. Anyone who has ever waited in line at the Department of Motor Vehicles, applied for a building permit, or tried to pay the nanny tax would agree. There's just one problem with that cocktail party sentiment. It's wrong. Good government makes a market economy possible. Period. And bad government, or no government, dashes capitalism against the rocks, which is one reason that billions of people live in dire poverty around the globe. To begin with, government sets the rules. Countries without functioning governments are not oases of free market prosperity. They're places in which it's expensive and difficult to conduct even the simplest business. Nigeria has one of the world's largest reserves of oil and natural gas. Yet firms trying to do business there face a problem known locally as BYOI, Bring Your Own Infrastructure. Angola is rich with oil and diamonds, but the wealth has financed more than a decade of civil war, not economic prosperity. In 1999, Angola's ruler spent $900 million in oil revenues to purchase weapons. Never mind that one child in three dies before the age of five, and life expectancy is a shocking 42 years. These are not countries in which the market economy has failed. They are countries in which the government has failed to develop and sustain the institutions necessary to support a market economy. A report issued by the United Nations Development Program placed much of the blame for world poverty on bad government. Without good governance, reliance on trickle-down economic development and a host of other strategies will not work, the report concluded. The reality is that nobody ever likes the umpire, but you can't play the World Series without one. So what are the rules for a functional market economy? First, the government defines and protects property rights. You own things, your home, your car, your dog, your golf clubs. Within reasonable limits, you can do with that property as you wish. You can sell it, or rent it, or pledge it as collateral. Most important, you can make investments in your property having full confidence that the returns from that investment will also belong to you. Imagine a world in which you spend all summer tending to your corn crop, and then your neighbor drives by in his combine, waves cheerily, and proceeds to harvest the whole crop for himself. Does that sound contrived? Not if you're a musician, because that's pretty much what Napster did by allowing individuals to download music without paying any compensation to the musicians who created it, or to the record companies that own the copyrights. The music industry successfully sued Napster for facilitating piracy. Property rights are not just about houses, cars, and things you can stack in a closet. Some of the most important property rights involve ownership of ideas, artwork, formulas, inventions, and even surgical procedures. This book is as good an example as any. I write the text. My agent sells it to a publisher, who contracts to have the book printed and distributed. The book is sold in private stores, where private security guards are hired to handle the massive, potentially unruly crowds trying to get a signed copy. At every juncture, only private parties are involved. These would appear to be straightforward market transactions. Government could only get in the way. Indeed, I might curse the government for taxing my income, taxing the sale of the book, even taxing the salary that I pay the nanny to look after my children while I write. In fact, the whole transaction is made possible by one thing, copyright law, which is a crucial form of property right for those of us who write for a living. The United States government guarantees that after I invest my time in producing a manuscript, no company can steal the text and publish it without compensating me. Any professor who photocopies it to use it in a class must pay the publisher a royalty first. Indeed, the government enforces similar rights for Microsoft software and a related property right, a patent, for the pharmaceutical company that invented Viagra. The case of patents is an interesting one that's often mischaracterized. The ingredients in Viagra cost pennies a pill, but because Pfizer has a patent on Viagra, that gives it a monopoly on the right to sell the product for 20 years. The company sells each pill for as much as $7. This huge markup, which is also common with new HIV/AIDS drugs and other life-saving products, is often described as some kind of social injustice perpetrated by rapacious companies, the big drug companies that are periodically demonized during presidential campaigns. What would happen if other companies were allowed to sell Viagra, or if Pfizer were forced to sell the drug more cheaply? The price would fall to the point where it was much closer to the cost of production. Indeed, when a drug comes off patent, the point at which generic substitutes become legal, the price usually falls by 80% or 90%. So why do we allow Pfizer to fleece Viagra users? Because if Viagra did not get patent protection, then Pfizer never would have made the large investments that were necessary to invent the drug in the first place. The real cost of breakthrough drugs is the research and development, scouring the world's rainforest for exotic tree barks with medicinal properties, not making the pills once the formula is discovered. The same is true with drugs for any other illness, no matter how serious or even life-threatening. I cannot fully explain why the pharmaceutical companies were so resistant to providing low-cost HIV/AIDS drugs to Africa. These countries will never be able to pay the high prices charged in the developed world, so the companies would not be foregoing profits by selling the drugs cheaply. In places like South Africa, it's either cheap drugs or no drugs. This would appear to be a perfect opportunity for price discrimination. Make the drugs cheap in Cape Town and expensive in New York. True, price discrimination could create an opportunity for a black market. Drugs sold cheaply in Africa could be resold illegally at high prices in New York. But that seems a manageable problem relative to the huge public relations cost of denying important drugs to large swaths of the world's population. The average cost of bringing a new drug to market is somewhere in the area of $600 million. And for every successful drug, there are many expensive research forays that end in failure. Is there a way to provide affordable drugs to low-income Americans or poor individuals elsewhere in the world without destroying the incentive to invent those drugs? Yes. The government could buy out the patent when a new drug is invented. The government would pay a firm up front a sum equal to what the firm would have earned over the course of its 20-year patent. After that, the government would own the property right and could charge whatever price for the drugs it deemed appropriate. It's an expensive solution that comes with some problems of its own. For example, which drug patents would the government buy? Is arthritis serious enough to justify using public funds to make a new drug more affordable? How about asthma? Still, this kind of plan is at least consistent with the economic reality. Individuals and firms will make investments only when they're guaranteed to reap what they sow, literally or figuratively. I once stumbled on a curious example of how ambiguous property rights can stifle economic development. I was working on a long story on American Indians for The Economist. Having spent time on a handful of reservations, I noticed that there was very little private housing stock. Tribal members lived either in houses that had been financed by the federal government or in trailers. Why? One principal reason is that it's difficult, if not impossible, to get a conventional home mortgage on an Indian reservation because the land is owned communally. A tribal member may be given a piece of land to use, but he or she does not own it, the Indian nation does. What that means to a commercial bank is that a mortgage that has fallen delinquent cannot be foreclosed. If a bank is denied that unpleasant but necessary option, then the lender is left without any effective collateral on its loan. A trailer, on the other hand, is different. If you fall delinquent on your payments, the company can show up one day and haul it off the reservation. But trailers, unlike conventional housing, do not support local building trades. They're assembled thousands of miles away in a factory and then transported to the reservation. That process does not provide jobs for roofers and masons and drywallers and electricians. And jobs are what America's Indian reservations need more than anything else. Government lowers the cost of doing business in the private sector in all kinds of ways. By providing uniform rules and regulations, such as contract law. By rooting out fraud. By circulating a sound currency. Government builds and maintains infrastructure, roads, bridges, ports, and dams, that makes private commerce less costly. E-commerce may be a modern wonder, but let's not lose sight of the fact that after you order khakis from Gap.com, they're dispatched from a distribution center in a truck barreling along an interstate. In the 1950s and 1960s, new roads, including the interstate highway system, accounted for a significant fraction of new capital created in the United States. And that investment in infrastructure is associated with large increases in productivity in industries that are vehicle-intensive. Effective regulation and oversight make markets more credible. Because of the diligence of the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, one can buy shares in a new company listed on the NASDAQ with a reasonable degree of certainty that neither the company nor the traders on the stock exchange are engaging in fraud. In short, government is responsible for the rule of law. Failure of the rule of law is one reason why nepotism, clans, and other family-centered behavior are so common in developing countries. In the absence of binding contractual agreements, business deals can be guaranteed only by some kind of personal relationship. Jerry Jordan, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, once mused on something that's obvious but too often taken for granted. Our sophisticated institutions, both public and private, make it possible to undertake complex transactions with total strangers. He noted, "It seems remarkable when you think about it, that we often take substantial amounts of money to our bank and hand it over to people we have never met before. Or that securities traders can send millions of dollars to people they don't know in countries they have never been in. Yet this occurs all the time. We trust that the infrastructure is set in place that allows us not to worry that the person at the bank who takes our money doesn't just pocket it. Or that when we use credit cards to buy a new CD or tennis racket over the Internet from a business that is located in some other state or country, we are confident we will get our merchandise, and they are confident they will get paid." Shakespeare may have advised us to get rid of all the lawyers, but he was a playwright, not an economist. The reality is that we all complain about lawyers until we've been wronged, at which point we run out and hire the best one we can find. Government enforces the rules in a reasonably fair and efficient manner. Is it perfect? No. But rather than singing the praises of the American justice system, let me simply provide a counterexample from India. Abdul Wahid filed a lawsuit against his neighbor, a milk merchant named Muhammad Nanhi, who had built several drains at the edge of his property that emptied into Mr. Wahid's front yard. Mr. Wahid did not like the water draining onto his property, in part because he had hoped to add a third room to his cement house, and he was worried that the drains would create a seepage problem. So he sued. The case came to trial in June 2000 in Moradabad, a city near New Delhi. There's one major complication with this civil dispute. The case had been filed 39 years earlier. Mr. Wahid was dead, and so was Mr. Nanhi. Their relatives inherited the case. By one calculation, if no new cases were filed in India, it would still take 324 years to clear all the existing cases from the docket. These are not just civil cases. In late 1999, a 75-year-old man was released from a Calcutta jail after waiting 37 years to be tried on murder charges. He was released because the witnesses and investigating officer were all dead. A judge had declared him mentally incompetent to stand trial in 1963, but the action was somehow lost. Bear in mind that by developing world standards, India has relatively good government institutions. In Somalia, these kinds of disputes are not resolved in the courts. All the while, government enforces antitrust laws that forbid companies from conspiring together in ways that erase the benefits of competition. Having three airlines that secretly collude when setting fares is no better than having one slovenly monopoly. The bottom line is that all these institutions form the tracks on which capitalism runs. Thomas Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times, once made this point in a column. Do you know how much your average Russian would give for a week of the U.S. Department of Justice busting Russia's oligarchs and monopolists? He queried. He pointed out that with many of the world's economies plagued by endemic corruption, particularly in the developing world, he has found that foreigners often envy us for, hold on to your latte here, our Washington bureaucrats, that is, our institutions, our courts, our bureaucracy, our military, and our regulatory agencies, the SEC, the Federal Reserve, the FAA, the FDA, the FBI, the EPA, the IRS, the INS, the U.S. Patent Office, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The government has another crucial role. It provides a wide array of goods, so-called public goods, that make us better off, but would not otherwise be provided by the private sector. Suppose I decide to buy an anti-missile system to protect myself from missiles lobbed by rogue nations. It would be similar to the DirecTV satellite dish, only a lot more expensive. I ask my neighbor Etienne if he would like to share the cost of this system. He says no, knowing full well that my missile defense will shield his house from any missiles that North Korea may send our way. Etienne and most of my other neighbors have a powerful incentive to be free riders on my system. At the same time, I do not want to pay the full cost of the system myself. In the end, we get no missile defense system, even though it might have made us all better off. Public goods have two salient characteristics. First, the cost of offering the good to additional users, even thousands or millions of people, is very low or even zero. Think of that missile defense system. If I pay to knock terrorist missiles out of the sky, the millions of people who live relatively close to me in the Chicago metropolitan area get that benefit free. The same is true of a radio signal, or a lighthouse, or a large park. Once it's operational for one person, it can serve thousands more at no extra cost. Second, it's very hard, if not impossible, to exclude persons who have not paid for the good from using it. How exactly do you tell a ship's captain that he can't use a lighthouse? Do you make him close his eyes as he sails by? Attention, USS Britannica, you are peaking. I once had a professor at Princeton who began his lecture on public goods by saying, "Okay, who are the suckers who actually contribute to public radio?" Free riders can cripple enterprises. Author Stephen King once attempted an experiment in which he offered his new novel directly to readers via the Internet. The plan was that he would offer monthly installments for readers to download in exchange for a $1 payment based on the honor system. He warned that the story would fold if fewer than 75% of readers made the voluntary payment. "If you pay, the story rolls. If you don't, it folds," he wrote on the website. The outcome was sadly predictable to economists who have studied these kinds of problems. the story folded. At the time, the plant went into hibernation. Only 46% of readers had paid to download the last chapter offered. That's the basic problem if public goods are left to private enterprise. Firms cannot force consumers to pay for these kinds of goods, no matter how much utility they may derive from them or how often they use them. Remember the lighthouse. And any system of voluntary payments falls prey to the free riders. Think about the following. Basic research. We've already discussed the powerful incentives that profits create for pharmaceutical companies and the like. But not all important scientific discoveries have immediate commercial applications. Exploring the universe, or understanding how human cells divide, or seeking subatomic particles may be many steps removed from launching a communication satellite, or developing a drug that shrinks tumors, or finding a cleaner source of energy. As important, this kind of research must be shared freely with other scientists in order to maximize its value. In other words, you won't get rich or even cover your costs in most cases by generating knowledge that may someday significantly advance the human condition. Most of America's basic research is done either directly by the government at places like NASA and the National Institutes for Health, or at research universities, which are non-profit institutions that receive federal funding. Law enforcement. There's no shortage of private security firms. Rent-a-cops, as we used to call them in college, as they aggressively sought out 20-year-old beer drinkers. But there is a limit to what they can or will do. They'll only defend your property against some kind of trespass. They will not proactively seek out criminals who might someday break into your house. They will not track Mexican drug kingpins or stop felons from entering the country or solve other crimes so that the perpetrator does not eventually attack you. All of these things would make you and your property safer in the long run, but they have inherent free rider problems. If I pay for this kind of security, everyone else in the country benefits at no cost. Everywhere in the world, most kinds of law enforcement are undertaken by government. Parks and open space. Chicago's lakefront is the city's greatest asset. For some 30 miles along Lake Michigan, there are parks and beaches owned by the city and protected from private development. If this is the best use of the land, which I firmly believe it is, then why wouldn't a private landowner use it for the same purposes? After all, we've just stipulated that private ownership of an asset ensures that it will be put to its most productive use. If I own 30 miles of lakefront, why couldn't I charge bicyclists and rollerbladers and picnickers in order to make a healthy profit on my investment? Two reasons. First, it would be a logistical nightmare to patrol such a large area and charge admission. More important, many of the people who value an open lakefront don't actually use it. They may enjoy the view from the window of a high-rise apartment or as they drive along Lakeshore Drive. A private developer would never collect anything from these people and would therefore undervalue the open space. This is true for many of America's natural resources. You've probably never been to Prince William Sound in Alaska, and may never go there. Yet, you almost certainly cared when the huge oil tanker Exxon Valdez ran aground and despoiled the area. Government can make us collectively better off by protecting these kinds of resources. Obviously, not all collective endeavors require the hand of government. Wikipedia is a pretty handy resource, even for those who don't make voluntary contributions to keep it up and running. Every school, church, and neighborhood has a group of eager beavers who do more than their fair share to provide important public benefits, to the great benefit of a much larger group of free riders. Those examples notwithstanding, there are compelling reasons to believe that society would underinvest in things that would make us better off without some kind of mechanism to force cooperation. As much as I love the spirit of Wikipedia, I'm comfortable leaving counterterrorism in the hands of the FBI, the government institution we've created and pay for with taxes to act on our behalf. Government redistributes wealth. We collect taxes from some citizens and provide benefits to others. Contrary to popular opinion, most government benefits do not go to the poor. They go to the middle class in the form of Medicare and Social Security. Still, government has the legal authority to play Robin Hood. Other governments around the world, such as the European countries, do so quite actively. What does economics have to say about this? Not much, unfortunately. The most important questions related to income distribution require philosophical or ideological answers, not economic ones. Consider the following question. Which would be a better state of the world? One in which every person in America earned $25,000, enough to cover the basic necessities? Or the status quo, in which some Americans are wildly rich, some are desperately poor, and the average income is somewhere around $48,000. The latter describes a bigger economic pie. The former would be a smaller pie, more evenly divided. Economics does not provide the tools for answering philosophical questions related to income distribution. For example, economists cannot prove that taking a dollar forcibly from Steve Jobs and giving it to a starving child would improve overall social welfare. Most people intuitively believe that to be so. But it's theoretically possible that Steve Jobs would lose more utility from having the dollar taken from him than the starving child would gain. This is an extreme example of a more general problem. We measure our well-being in terms of utility, which is a theoretical concept, not a measurement tool that can be quantified, compared among individuals, or aggregated for the nation. We cannot say, for example, that candidate A's tax plan would generate 120 units of utility for the nation, while candidate B's tax plan would generate only 111. Consider the following question posed by Amartya Sen, winner of the 1998 Nobel Prize in Economics. Three men have come to you looking for work. You have only one job to offer. The work cannot be divided among the three of them, and they are all equally qualified. One of your goals is to make the world a better place by hiring the man who needs the job most. The first man is the poorest of the three. If improving human welfare is your primary aim, then presumably he should get the job. Or maybe not. The second man is not the poorest, but he is the unhappiest, because he has only recently become poor and he's not accustomed to the deprivation. Offering him the job will cause the greatest gain in happiness. The third man is neither the poorest nor the unhappiest, but he has a chronic health problem, born stoically for his whole life, that can be cured with the wages from the job. Thus, giving him the job would have the most profound effect on an individual's quality of life. Who should get the job? As would be expected of a Nobel Prize winner, Mr. Sen has many interesting things to say about this dilemma. But the bottom line is that there is no right answer. The same thing is true, contrary to what politicians on both sides of the political spectrum will tell you, with issues related to the redistribution of wealth in a modern economy. Will a tax increase that funds a better safety net for the poor but lowers overall economic growth make the country better off? That is a matter of opinion, not economic expertise. Note that every presidential administration is able to find very qualified economists to support its ideological positions. Liberals, in the American sense of the word, often ignore the fact that a growing pie, even if unequally divided, will almost always make even the small pieces larger. The developing world needs economic growth, to which international trade contributes heavily, to make the poor better off, period. One historical reality is that government policies that ostensibly serve the poor can be ineffective or even counterproductive if they hobble the broader economy. Meanwhile, conservatives often blithely assume that we should all rush out into the street and cheer for any policy that makes the economy grow faster, neglecting the fact that there are perfectly legitimate intellectual grounds for supporting other policies, such as protecting the environment or redistributing income that may diminish the overall size of the pie. Indeed, some evidence suggests that our sense of well-being is determined at least as much by our relative wealth as it is by our absolute level of wealth. In other words, we derive utility not just from having a big television, but from having a television that is as big as or bigger than the neighbor's. Then there's one of the most controversial questions of all. Should government protect people from themselves? Should society expend resources to stop you from doing stupid things that don't affect the rest of us? Or is that your business? The most important thing to realize is that the answer to this question is philosophical. The best economics can do is frame the range of defensible views. At one end of the continuum is the belief that individuals are rational, or at least more rational than government, meaning that individual citizens are the best judge of what is good for them, not the rest of us. If you like to sniff glue and then roll backward down the basement steps, good for you. Just make sure that you pay all your own health care costs and don't drive a car after you've been into the glue. The behavioral economists have provided plenty of ammunition for the opposite end of the continuum, where reasonable people argue that society can and should stop people from doing things that are likely to turn out badly. We have good evidence that human decision-making is prone to certain kinds of errors, such as underestimating risk or planning poorly for the future. As a practical matter, those mistakes often do spill over to affect the rest of us, as we saw in the real estate collapse and the accompanying mortgage mess. And there's a range of views in between. For example, you're allowed to sniff glue and roll down the steps, but only while wearing a helmet. One intriguing and practical middle ground is the notion of libertarian paternalism, which was advanced in an influential book called Nudge by Richard Thaler. A professor of behavioral science and economics at the University of Chicago, and Cass Sunstein, a Harvard Law School professor now serving in the Obama administration. The idea behind benign paternalism is that individuals do make systematic errors of judgment, but society should not force you to change your behavior. That's the libertarian part. Instead, we should merely point you in the right direction. That's the paternalism part. One of Thaler and Sunstein's key insights is that our decisions are often a product of inertia. If our employer automatically signs us up for some kind of insurance coverage, then we'll stick with that, even if six other plans are offered. Conversely, we may not sign up for any plan at all if it requires some proactive behavior on our part, reading a benefits manual, filling out a form, going to a stupid human resources seminar, or doing anything else that involves time and effort. Thaler and Sunstein propose that inertia and other decision-making foibles can be used to some advantage. If policymakers are concerned about some individual behavior, such as inadequate retirement savings, then the libertarian paternalistic option is to make the default option one that automatically puts a decent amount of money from every paycheck into a retirement account. That's the nudge. Anyone is free to choose another option at any time, but a shockingly high proportion of people will stay wherever you put them in the first place. This idea has profound implications when it comes to something like organ donation. Spain, France, Norway, Israel, and many other countries have opt-out or presumed consent laws when it comes to organ donation. You are an organ donor unless you indicate otherwise, which you are free to do. In contrast, the United States has an opt-in system, meaning that you are not an organ donor unless you sign up to be one. Inertia matters even when it comes to something as serious as organ donation. Economists have found that presumed consent laws have a significant positive effect on organ donation, controlling for relevant country characteristics such as religion and health expenditures. Spain has one of the highest rates of cadaveric organ donations in the world, 50% higher than the United States. True libertarians, as opposed to the paternalistic kind, reject presumed consent laws because they imply that the government owns your internal organs until you make some effort to get them back. Good government matters. The more sophisticated our economy becomes, the more sophisticated our government institutions need to be. The Internet is a perfect example. The private sector is the engine of growth for the web economy, but it's the government that roots out fraud, makes online transactions legally binding, sorts out property rights such as domain names, settles disputes, and deals with issues that we have not even thought about yet. One sad irony of September 11th was that one simple-minded view of government, that taxpayers know better what to do with their money than the government does, was exposed for its hollowness. Individual taxpayers cannot gather intelligence, track down a fugitive in the mountains of Afghanistan, do research on bioterrorism, or protect planes and airports. It is true that if the government takes money out of my paycheck, then there are things that would have given me utility that I can no longer buy. But it's also true that there are things that would make me better off that I cannot buy for myself. I cannot build a missile defense system, or protect endangered species, or stop global warming, or install traffic lights, or regulate the New York Stock Exchange, or negotiate lower trade barriers with China. Government enables us to work collectively to do those things. Chapter 4. Government and the Economy, 2. The Army was lucky to get that screwdriver for $500. By now, you're probably ready to extol the virtues of bureaucracy at your next dinner party. Not so fast. If government were so wonderful, then the most government-intensive countries in the world, places like North Korea and Cuba, would be economic powerhouses. They're not. Government is good at doing some things and tragically bad at doing others. Government can deal with significant externalities, or it can regulate an economy to the point of ruin. Government can provide essential public goods, or it can squander enormous tax revenues on ineffective programs and pet projects. Government can transfer money from the wealthy to the disadvantaged, or it can transfer money from common folk to the politically well-connected. In short, government can be used to create the foundations for a vibrant market economy or to stifle highly productive behavior. The wisdom, of course, lies in telling the difference. There's an old joke, one of Ronald Reagan's favorites, that goes something like this. A Soviet woman is trying to buy a Lada, one of the cheap automobiles made in the former Soviet Union. The dealer tells her that there is a shortage of these cars, despite their reputation for shoddy quality. Still, the woman insists on placing an order. The dealer gets out a large, dusty ledger and adds the woman's name to the long waiting list. "Come back 2 years from now, on March 17th, he says. The woman consults her calendar. "Morning or afternoon?" she asks. "What difference does it make?" the surly dealer replies. "That's 2 years from now." "The plumber is coming that day," she says. If the USSR taught us anything, it's that monopoly stifles any need to be innovative or responsive to customers. And government is one very large monopoly. Why is the clerk at the Department of Motor Vehicles plodding and surly? Because she can be. What would your business look like if your customers, by law, could not go anywhere else? It would certainly make me think twice about working late, or for that matter, working at all on warm summer days when the Cubs were playing at home. Government operations are often described as inefficient. In fact, they operate exactly as we would expect, given their incentives. Think about the Department of Motor Vehicles, which has a monopoly on the right to grant driver's licenses. What is the point of being friendly, staying open longer, making customers comfortable, adding clerks to shorten lines, keeping the office clean, or interrupting a personal call when a customer comes to the window? None of these things will produce even one more customer. Every single person who needs a driver's license already comes to the DMV and will continue to come no matter how unpleasant the experience. There are limits, of course. If service becomes bad enough, then voters may take action against the politicians in charge. But that's an indirect, cumbersome process. Compare that to your options in the private sector. If a rat scampered across the counter at your favorite Chinese takeout restaurant, you would, presumably, just stop ordering there. End of problem. The restaurant will get rid of the rats or go out of business. Meanwhile, if you stop going to the Department of Motor Vehicles, you may end up in jail. This contrast was illustrated to me quite sharply when a check I was expecting from Fidelity, the mutual fund company, failed to show up in the mail. I needed the money to pay back my mother, who can be a fierce creditor. Day after day went by, no check. Meanwhile, my mother was checking in with increasing frequency. One of two parties was guilty, Fidelity or the U.S. Postal Service, and I was getting progressively more angry. Finally, I called Fidelity to demand proof that the check had been mailed. I was prepared to move all of my relatively meager assets to Vanguard, Putnam, or some other mutual fund company, or at least make the threat. Instead, I spoke with a very friendly customer assistant who explained that the check had been mailed 2 weeks earlier, but apologized profusely for my inconvenience anyway. She canceled the check and issued another one in a matter of seconds. Then she apologized some more for a problem that, it was now apparent, her company did not cause. The culprit was the post office. So I got even angrier, and then I did nothing. What exactly was I supposed to do? The local postmaster does not accept complaints by phone. I did not want to waste time writing a letter, which might never arrive anyway. Nor would it help to complain to our letter carrier, who has never been consumed by the quality of his service. Roughly once a month he gets off by a house and delivers every family's mail to the house one door to the west. The point, carefully disguised in this diatribe, is that the U.S. Postal Service has a monopoly on the delivery of first-class mail, and it shows. There are two broader lessons to be learned from this. First, government should not be the sole provider of a good or a service unless there's a compelling reason to believe that the private sector will fail in that role. This exclusion leaves plenty for government to do in areas ranging from public health to national defense. Having just lambasted the Department of Motor Vehicles, I must admit that issuing driver's licenses is probably a function that should remain in the hands of government. Private firms issuing driver's licenses might not compete only on price and quality of service. They'd have a powerful incentive to attract customers by issuing licenses to drivers who don't deserve them. Still, that leaves a lot of things the government should not be doing. Delivering mail is one of them. A century ago, the government may have had legitimate reasons for being in the mail business. The U.S. Postal Service indirectly assisted underdeveloped regions of the country by guaranteeing mail delivery at a subsidized rate, since delivering mail to remote areas is more expensive than delivering to a metropolitan area, but the stamp costs the same. The technology was different, too. In 1820, it was unlikely that more than one private firm would have made the massive investment necessary to build a system that could deliver mail anywhere in the country. A private monopoly is no better, and perhaps worse, than a government monopoly. Times have changed. FedEx and UPS have proved that private firms are perfectly capable of building worldwide delivery infrastructures. Is there a huge economic cost associated with mediocre mail service? Probably not. But imagine the U.S. Postal Service controlling other important sectors of the economy. Elsewhere in the world, the government runs steel mills, coal mines, banks, hotels, airlines. All the benefits that competition can bring to these businesses are lost, and citizens are made worse off as a result. Food for thought. One of the largest government monopolies remaining in the United States is public education. There's a second, more subtle point. Even if government has an important role to play in the economy, such as building roads and bridges, it does not follow that government must actually do the work. Government employees do not have to be the ones pouring cement. Rather, government can plan and finance a new highway and then solicit bids from private contractors to do the work. If the bidding process is honest and competitive, big ifs in many cases, then the project will go to the firm that can do the best work at the lowest cost. In short, a public good is delivered in a way that harnesses all the benefits of the market. This distinction is sometimes lost on American taxpayers, a point that Barack Obama made during one of his town hall meetings on health care reform. He said, "I got a letter the other day from a woman. She said, 'I don't want government-run health care. I don't want socialized medicine. And don't touch my Medicare.'" The irony, of course, is that Medicare is government-run health care. The program allows Americans over age 65 to seek care from their private doctors, who are then reimbursed by the federal government. Even the Central Intelligence Agency has taken this lesson to heart. The CIA needs to be on the cutting edge of technology, yet it cannot provide the same incentives to innovate as the private sector can. Someone who makes a breakthrough discovery at the CIA will not find himself or herself worth hundreds of millions of dollars 6 months later, as might happen at a Silicon Valley startup. So, the CIA decided to use the private sector for its own ends by using money appropriated by Congress to open its own venture capital firm, named Incuit, in a sly reference to Q, the technology guru who develops gadgets for James Bond. An Incuit executive explained that the purpose of the venture was to move information technology to the agency more quickly than traditional government procurement processes allow. Like any other venture capital firm, Incuit will make investments in small firms with promising new technologies. Incuit and the firms it bankrolls will make money, perhaps a lot of money, if these technologies turn out to have valuable commercial applications. At the same time, the CIA will retain the right to use any new technology with potential intelligence-gathering applications. A Silicon Valley entrepreneur funded by Incuit may develop a better way to encrypt data on the Internet, something that e-commerce firms would snap up. Meanwhile, the CIA would end up with a better way to safeguard information sent to Washington by covert operatives around the world. In the private sector, markets tell us where to devote our resources. While sitting in the center field seats at a Chicago White Sox game, I spotted a vendor walking through the stands wearing what was prominently advertised as the Margarita Space Pack. This piece of technology enabled the vendor to make frozen margaritas on the spot. Somehow, he mixed the drinks in his backpack-like device and then poured them through a hose into plastic cups. The ostensible social benefit of this breakthrough technology was that baseball fans could now enjoy margaritas rather than just beer without leaving their seats. I suspect that some of our country's top engineering minds, a scarce resource, devoted their time and effort to creating the Margarita Space Pack, which means they were not spending their time searching for a cheaper, cleaner source of energy or a better way to deliver nutrients to malnourished children in Africa. Does the world need the Margarita space pack? No. Could the engineering minds that created it have been put to some more socially useful purpose? Yes. But this is an important point. That's my opinion, and I don't run the world. When government controls some element of the economy, scarce resources are allocated by autocrats or bureaucrats or politicians rather than by the market. In the former Soviet Union, massive steel plants churned out tons of steel. But the average citizen couldn't buy soap or decent cigarettes. In hindsight, it should not have been a surprise that the USSR was the first to send a rocket into orbit, and equally obvious that it would not invent the Margarita space pack. The government could simply mandate that resources be spent on the space program, even if people would rather have had fresh vegetables or tube socks. Some of these resource allocation decisions were tragic. For example, Soviet central planners did not consider birth control to be an economic priority. The Soviet government could have made contraceptives available to all. Any country that can build intercontinental ballistic missiles has the know-how to make a birth control pill, or at least a condom. But contraception simply was not where central planners chose to channel the country's resources, leaving abortion as the only form of family planning. In the years of communism, there were roughly 2 abortions for every single live birth. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, Western contraceptives have become widely available, and the abortion rate has fallen by half. Even in democratic countries, the political process can devote resources to some pretty strange places. I once interviewed a technology expert about the government's plans at the time to build a high-speed particle accelerator, a good example of basic research. The accelerator would bring jobs and federal money to the location that landed the project. This was in the early 1990s, and the 2 leading sites were northern Illinois and somewhere in Texas. According to the fellow I was speaking with, Illinois was the more attractive site because it already had a particle accelerator and a major federal laboratory. Much of the scientific infrastructure was in place and would not have to be duplicated. Despite that, the project was sited in Texas. Why? I asked. This guy looked at me as if I were some kind of idiot. Because George H.W. Bush was president, he answered, as if there could be no more obvious reason to put a giant particle accelerator in Texas. In the end, the government spent roughly $1 billion on the project and then abandoned it. The private sector allocates resources where they will earn the highest return. In contrast, the government allocates resources wherever the political process sends them. Consider a front-page headline in the Wall Street Journal. Industries that backed Bush are now seeking return on investment. Is that because Republicans are particularly prone to this kind of money-grubbing political influence? Perhaps. But that wouldn't explain this more recent New York Times headline. In Washington, one bank chief still holds sway. The story began, Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, will hold a meeting of his board here in the nation's capital for the first time on Monday, with a special guest expected, the White House Chief of Staff, Rahm Emanuel. Mr. Emanuel's appearance would underscore the pull of Mr. Dimon, who, amid the disgrace of his industry, has emerged as President Obama's favorite banker, and in turn, the envy of his Wall Street rivals. It also reflects a good return on what Mr. Dimon has labeled his company's 7th line of business, government relations. There is nothing inherently wrong with this. Politics is a necessary but imperfect process, and everyone has a right to seek influence. Military bases get built or closed in a way that reflects the makeup of the Senate Armed Services Committee as much as or more than the military needs of the country. A private army is not an option, so this is the best we can reasonably expect. But the less the economy is left to politics, the better. powerful politicians should not be deciding, for example, who gets bank credit and who does not. Yet that's exactly what happens in autocratic nations like China, and in democratic countries like Indonesia, where politicians play crony capitalism. Projects that have the potential to be highly profitable do not get financing, while dubious undertakings sponsored by the president's brother-in-law are lavished with government funds. Consumers lose in two ways. First, their tax money is squandered when projects that never should have been funded in the first place go bust, or when the whole banking system needs to be bailed out because it's full of rotten, politically motivated loans. Second, the economy does not develop as quickly or efficiently as it might because credit, a finite resource, is channeled away from worthwhile projects. Car plants don't get built. Students don't get loans. Entrepreneurs don't get funding. As a result, resources are squandered and the economy does not perform anywhere near its potential. Government need not run steel mills or parcel out bank loans to meddle in the economy. The more subtle and pervasive kind of government involvement is regulation. Markets work because resources flow to where they're valued most. Government regulation inherently interferes with that process. In the world painted by economics textbooks, entrepreneurs cross the road to earn higher profits. In the real world, government officials stand by the road and demand a toll if they don't block the crossing entirely. The entrepreneurial firm may have to obtain a license to cross the road or have its vehicle emissions tested by the Department of Transportation as it crosses the road, or prove to the INS that the workers crossing the road are U.S. citizens. Some of these regulations may make us better off. It's good to have government officials blocking the road when the entrepreneur is carrying 7 kilos of cocaine. But every single regulation carries a cost, too. Milton Friedman, who was a delightful writer and an articulate spokesman for a less intrusive government, and a far more subtle thinker than many of the writers who haunt the op-ed pages these days purporting to have inherited his mantle, makes this point in Capitalism and Freedom by recounting an exchange between an economist and a representative of the American Bar Association at a large meeting of lawyers. The economist was arguing before the group that admission to the bar should be less restrictive. Allowing more lawyers to practice, including those who might not be the sharpest knives in the drawer, would lower the cost of legal services, he argued. After all, some legal procedures, such as basic wills and real estate closings, do not require the services of a brilliant constitutional scholar. He argued, by analogy, that it would be absurd for the government to require that all automobiles be Cadillacs. At that point, a lawyer in the audience rose and said, "The country cannot afford anything but Cadillac lawyers." In fact, demanding only Cadillac lawyers completely misses all that economics seeks to teach us about trade-offs, for reasons that have nothing to do with the fact that General Motors is a basket case. In a world with only Cadillacs, most people would not be able to afford any transportation at all. Sometimes there's nothing wrong with allowing people to drive Toyota Corollas. To drive Toyota Corollas. For a striking international example of the effects of regulation on the economy, consider the civil unrest in 2000 in Delhi, India. Delhi is one of the most polluted cities in the world. After the Supreme Court of India made a major decision regarding industrial pollution, thousands of Delhi residents took to the streets in violent protest. Mobs torched buses, threw stones, and blocked major roads, the New York Times reported. Here's the twist. The protesters were supporting the polluters. The Supreme Court held the city of Delhi in contempt for failing to close some 90,000 small factories that pollute the area. Those factories employed roughly 1 million people who would be thrown out of work. The headline of the story nicely encapsulated the trade-off. A cruel choice in New Delhi. Jobs versus a safer environment. How about DDT? One of the nastier chemicals mankind has unleashed on the environment. DDT is a persistent organic pollutant that works its way into and up the food chain, wreaking havoc along the way. Should this noxious pesticide be banned from the planet? The Economist has made a convincing argument that it should not. Much of the developing world is ravaged by malaria. Some 300 million people suffer from the disease every year.